For that unusual topic, I'm talking with Cindy Klein, who has been leading and guiding kosher tours around the world since 2017. She has just wrapped up a whirlwind Jewish tour of none other than Japan. And now she's somewhere between Tokyo and Tel Aviv in the United States, where she's finally catching her breath. From kosher sushi to Shabbat in Kyoto, Cindy's got stories to share. And we cross now to her to hear about the unexpected, the unforgettable, and the uniquely Jewish moments from her recent trip to Japan. Cindy, thanks so much for chatting with us. Where are you at the moment? And are you one of those people that's been delayed getting a flight back to Israel?
Hi, Paula. First of all, thank you for having me on the show, and it's good to talk to you. I'm actually right now in a town called Passaic, New Jersey. When it came time to leave Tokyo and I knew I couldn't get back to Israel, I decided to take the opportunity to go visit family in the States. So I'm spending some time on the East Coast and moving over to Chicago on Wednesday to see my family there. And in the meantime, I hope I'll be able to get back to Israel by mid-July.
Well, that's mid-July, okay. I mean, you've got a bit of time. I've been speaking to people who are planning to get there by tomorrow. So, I mean, my vote is on you.
Cindy? Yeah, well, originally I was supposed to be in the States through mid-July anyway. I just wasn't supposed to get here this early.
Okay, so you can tell your family you miss them.
Yeah.
Tell me about your kosher culinary adventures in Japan. Firstly, where did the idea to do kosher Japan come from? And secondly, any quirky taste combinations or surprise favorites when it comes to kosher culinary adventures in Japan?
Okay, I have to say that when we come on tours to Japan, kosher tours to Japan came about because people who keep kosher and keep Shabbat, they want to travel around the world. So I, you know, not just Japan, I do tours all over the world, and then we make sure that people can visit anywhere in the world, and we make sure that they'll have kosher food and be able to keep Shabbos. Having Jewish communities or Chabad around help us do that, but we even when we don't have that infrastructure, we make it happen wherever we go. Regarding kosher culinary adventures in Japan, that being said, most of our food by Chabad, so we eat a lot of Israeli-style, Jewish-style food. But that being said, we try when possible to give them a Japanese experience, even though it's not easy, because your regular Japanese restaurants are not kosher. So at the Chabad in Kobe, which they host us for quite a few days, they make a special Japanese evening, and they have someone in their community who's a Japanese woman who's converted to Judaism, and she has adapted many recipes. So I'd say the most quirky and the most interesting thing that we have eaten is something called takoyaki. Takoyaki, taco actually means octopus, and yaki
okay.
means like roasted or cooked. Obviously,
you're not selling me on this.
we're not eating octopus, but this woman, Yehudit, has adapted this recipe, and it's basically these like fried sort of dumpling dough balls that are usually filled with chunks of octopus and other things. We have them with just vegetables and the batter, and it's made in this really, you can look it up online, it's really cool, like, there are these little balls in this cool machine that's only for making takoyaki. And that's actually a street food that originated like in the Osaka area. And you can see these everywhere you go in like the Osaka, Kobe, Kyoto area, you'll see people on the streets selling takoyaki. But we get to eat it kosher style.
And Cindy, what was the group's reaction when you landed in Tokyo? Were there only in Japan moments that had everyone laughing or wide-eyed?
So you're going to laugh when I tell you this?
Good.
The toilets. The toilets. Okay.
I think I know why, because I've been to Japan. Are they absolutely world-class and sophisticated and complicated?
They are amazing. First of all, many of them, like in the hotel we were staying, you just walk into the bathroom and the toilet lid opens up for you. So already it's like, hello.
Hello, we're not used to this.
And then you sit down and it's warm and you're like wondering, was someone just here? But no, it's been. And then there are, as you said, there's a gazillion. Oh, and then it starts making music and noises and you're wondering what's happening here. There's a million buttons and they're very, very state of the art. We even at one of the like gas station rest stops that we stop at, you can choose your language menu because they know of all the tourists. And I think there's like 20 languages you can choose from for the toilet to talk to you and explain to you what it's doing. There's no Hebrew.
No Hebrew.
But there is English.
Cindy, I have to confess.
Maybe Afrikaans. Maybe, no.
I didn't ask that. I mean, I shouldn't confess this on radio, but when I went, I was so busy pressing all the buttons on the toilet that at the end of the day, I actually didn't know how to flush the toilet. I had to get someone to come and help me.
Yeah, it's very hard. Nowadays, they write in big English letters, flush.
I think everyone had the same experience.
Yeah, everyone had the same experience. Or even since COVID, I don't know if it's since COVID, because I've only been there since post-COVID, but they have like a touch-free option for flushing that you just put your hand on. Anyway. But I'm sorry. We just spent so much time on toilets.
Yeah, okay, let's move on. Enough about the toilets.
One of the things that people laugh about when they come in.
Cindy, how did the group manage Shabbat? Hotel arrangements, minyan logistics, and even synagogue visits?
So Shabbat in general is getting more and more complicated for religious Orthodox Jewish tourists wherever they travel around the world because everything has sensors and there's no more regular keys to doors. And, there's a lot of things involved and elevators and everything, that an Orthodox tourist would have difficulty with. But in Japan, it's even more complicated because they don't allow you to use the stairs in hotels. Stairs are only for emergency fire escapes, emergency escapes. And I know a colleague of mine was actually with a group and the Israelis decided to break the rules and they actually got kicked out of the hotel on Shabbat for using the stairs.
Sorry for interrupting. Israelis decided to break the rules? I can't get my head around that. How unusual.
Very unusual, huh? Uh-huh. Yeah, anyway, so, but how do we manage? On my tour in Japan, I have an amazing, amazing Japanese logistics guide working with me. And she is our Shabbat goy, so she brings us up and down on the elevator. I don't want to confess online how we deal with getting in and out of our rooms, but we have our methods to get in and out of our rooms halachically. and when it comes to minyan and synagogue, we stay in Kobe for Shabbat, not Kyoto. And Kobe actually has a long, long history. That's for another show. Just to talk about the Jewish history
of
Kobe.
I'm making a note of it right now.
Since the 1860s, there have been Jews living in Kobe, and because there's still a Jewish community there, we spend Shabbat there. We eat all our meals with the Jewish community. We daven all our tefillot, all of our prayers with the Jewish community there. So we actually have a very, very beautiful Shabbat there. And on our Shabbat also, because Kobe has a history of a Jewish community, on the way to Shul and on the way back from Shul, I usually conduct two walking tours, and we get to see also the houses where the Jews used to live, and it's actually only a wall, a kotel, left of the original Jewish community in Kobe. We show them those sites and give them a talk about the Jewish community that once was.
Where did those Jews come from originally?
So the Jews today's Jewish community is something completely different, and I don't think there are any descendants of the original Jewish community. But the original Jewish community started in the 1860s when Japan opened up its seas to foreigners because it was closed off from the world for over 250 years, and in came an influx first of Jewish businessmen from Iraq and Iran, very time, yes, at this time. And then there was an influx of Jews from Russia as well before the turn of the century and after the turn of the century, because also of religious persecution in Russia, pogroms and such. And afterwards, you had a wave of Jews coming, Lithuanian Jews coming in the post-Holocaust. They were initially meant to come just as transit visas through Japan to go elsewhere, but many ended up settling in Japan for a while. So you had a community of around 4,000 or 5,000 Jews in Kobe alone for a certain period of time.
Amazing. So,
but again, I would say this is a whole talk.
Okay, so we'll keep that for another show.
Like 45. I'm giving a talk on it in Chicago. It's at least a 45-minute talk here.
Cindy, but were there moments when Japanese customs, like bowing, tea ceremonies, or even temple etiquette, meshed surprisingly well with Jewish tradition?
So it's very interesting that you asked that question, because, you know, on one hand, you know, Japan is completely different, and, you know, they are polytheistic versus Judaism, and you'd think, you know, this Shinto religion, Buddhism, it's completely foreign to Judaism, and then you see things that are similar. First of all, in the Shinto religion, before you enter a shrine is a Shinto temple, you have to wash your hands twice on each side. Sound familiar? Or the Jews do.
It even sounds familiar to me.
Temple, but what?
No, it definitely sounds familiar to someone even like me.
Even to you. But we don't do it before we enter a temple, but we do, you know, the idea of purifying yourself by washing your hands. They also wash their mouths, and they have, I call it their nitilat yadayim, their washing station, you know, outside. While in Japan, it's a little bit confusing because there's a lot of blurring of lines between Buddhism and Shinto. You'll see it sometimes outside of a Buddhist temple as well. But when I wanted to share a small anecdote of taking that concept to sharing even, call it philosophies or outlooks. There is outside of one of the, actually, it's actually outside of a Buddhist temple, there is a wash basin, again, because in Japan the lines are blurred, and there's an inscription on it, and I'm going to loosely translate the inscription, but the inscription is actually a Zen Buddhist saying that I'm going to loosely translate it, but something along the lines is, I will be satisfied with what I have. And the first time I saw that, I'm like, oh my God, wow. And if you're not familiar, in the ethics of our fathers, Pirkei Avot, there's a quote from the rabbis there in Hebrew, Ezehu Ashir Hasamech Chelko, who is rich? He who is happy with his lot. And the truth is, I was reading up on it, the Zen quote is almost exactly the same, and I show this to people, and it's engraved there on the washing basin. I said, here we are, you know, outside a Buddhist temple. Some Jews say they won't, we don't go, again, I have Orthodox Jews, so we don't go in, but we do go on the grounds of temples and shrines, and I say, you know, we think it's so foreign to us, and we see, wow, It's something as deep, you know, of the deep value that we share. And I see others, you know, I find the similarities in the philosophies as well. And, you know, the greatest of rabbis, the Maimonides, and in more modern times, Rav Shimshon, Raphael Hirsch, they both, their idea was, we should take what we can from foreign from foreign philosophies and even religions, as long as it doesn't contradict our own. And we see that we have many things that are in common. That's while some things are drastically different. So I find that fascinating, and I try to bring that to the attention of my tourists as much as possible, the things that we share and the things that are crazily different.
Cindy, I could talk to you for hours, and I probably would if I didn't have a clock and have to move on. But I'm going to take you up on that offer of the Jewish history of Kobe, and we'll definitely have you back on the show. For those who are wondering how I got hold of an American to chat to a mostly South African radio show, Cindy, you don't mind me saying who your husband is, do you? Now you're going to say, yes, I'm offended.
No, I'm not embarrassed.
So many of us know Doron Klein, who was, of course, a shaliach here in South Africa, and he is the CEO of Telfed. And Cindy, I know from South Africa. Many of you might know her as well. And Cindy, what amazing travels you are having around the world. We'll definitely have you back. And for anyone who's interested, where's your next kosher tour to?
If I do manage to get there, considering the situation in Israel right now, I'm meant to be going to Peru. In August. And afterwards, at the end of August, I'm meant to be going to do a Jewish heritage tour in Greece and North Macedonia.